afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor at Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, November 16th, Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, will talk about peace in the Middle East. On Wednesday, November 17th, the inventor of Barney, Cheryl Leach, will discuss kids and television. And on Monday, November 22nd, Catherine McKinnon, a professor at University of Michigan Law School, will discuss violence against women. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include the president of Harrah's Casinos, Phil Satry, Sarajevo newspaper editor Zlatko Dizdarevic, U.S. Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, FBI director Louis Free, and TV producer Norman Lear. I'd like to remind you that transcripts and audio and video tapes of this luncheon are available. The transcripts will be available for fax transmission within 2 hours. The transcripts or tapes may be ordered by calling 1-800-500-9911. All of those sales benefit our library, our scholarship program. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold applause until all the names are read. From your right, Joe Hinshaw, former INS UPI foreign correspondent, an Indiana University grad, and also a member of the Indiana University Public Affairs Council. Bob Hamill, sports editor, Bloomington, Indiana, Herald Times. Gene McManus, deputy sports editor of the Washington Post. I'd like to break the rules here and ask you all to give her a big round of applause. Thank you. Perhaps I should explain. My wife works at the sports desk at the Washington Post. And Gene is her boss. So. Next, we have Harry Stouffer of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Does anybody here need to suck up to Harry? Sorry. Dan Thomason, Washington Bureau Chief of Scripps Howard News Service. Mr. P.A. Mack, Vice President of the Indiana University Board of Trustees.
Is your wife Jean in the audience?
No.
She's back working at the Post?
She's at home with our four-year-old. She works nights.
Oh.
And her name is...
Good.
All those in favor of my wife getting a raise, please applaud. Thank you very much. Mr. Reginald Stewart, assistant news editor of Knight Ridder Newspapers and chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Kristen Huckshorn of the San Jose Mercury News. Clarence Doninger, director of athletics, Indiana University. Gordon Smith, President of Gordon L. Smith Public Relations, member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Bob Thompson, columnist for Hearst Newspapers. And Jeffrey Marks, a freelance journalist. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, Melanie Abdo-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. If we had to describe today's guest in a single phrase, it would probably be Mr. Nice Guy. Bob Knight, commonly known to most of us as Bobby Knight and to some like Dick Vitale as Robert Montgomery Knight, is a legend in collegiate basketball, not just for his widely publicized antics and temper, but for his skill at teaching kids how to win the game. Among the trophies he has coached winning teams to are the NCAA and NIT championships, the Olympic and Pan American gold medals, and a remarkable 759 winning average at Indiana University since 1971. His disciplined style of play has consistently produced top-ranked teams, even when his players are not individual stars. Locally, the Bullets' top draft choice this year is a Bobby Knight special, Kelbert Cheney. But it's not just pro players Bobby Knight has produced. His winning team staffs over the years have gone on to successful head coaching careers of their own. Duke's Mike Krzyzewski, Joe B. Wright, and Gail Doherty. In recognition of his achievements, Knight was elected in May 1991 to the National Basketball Hall of Fame. A native of Orville, Ohio, near Akron, Knight got his start in collegiate basketball at Ohio State. His teammates included Jerry Lucas, John Havlicek, and Larry Siegfried. It's not just winning that has earned Knight a reputation, however. He is tough on his players and even tougher on the press. I'm sure today will be no exception. He's also known for the high graduation rate of his players, one of the highest among big-time basketball schools. He's considered as big on the value of education as winning on the court. That's why on his campus he has a reputation for being as effective in generating support of the school's library as he is at coaching. Believe it or not, it's Bobby Knight who says the key to excellence at IU is the libraries. That's a burning question on college campuses today and within the college coaching community. Where should academic standards kick in and kick sports out? Mr. Knight, I'm sure, has some strong feelings about that as well. Ladies and gentlemen, Indiana coach Bob Knight.
Clayton, I really appreciated the reception that was given when your wife was brought up, working on the sports department or in the sports department of the Washington Post. She's got to be a very nice lady, got to be an intelligent lady, has to have an understanding of what the hell is going on, which makes up for a couple of other people I know in the sports department at the Washington Post. So I'm glad that your wife cancels out a couple of those guys there. I listened with interest at a couple of your upcoming speakers. Kids and television, I'd enjoy that. That's kind of at my intellectual level. I can understand that one. But I would really like to be put down for a tape, if you would mark me down for the tape before we go any further on peace in the Middle East. I mean, because if somebody can come up with that solution, then defending against some of the teams we have to defend against this year will be very, very simple. So make sure I get the tape of your meeting and your questions on peace in the Middle East. That would be interesting. When I started coaching at Indiana, I received a telegram from the Indiana University Alumni Association in Indianapolis. Now, our state capital and our largest city and our largest alumni group in Indianapolis. And I still have the telegram framed behind my desk, and it goes like this: Dear Coach Knight, congratulations on being named head coach at our alma mater. We're with you all the way, win or tie. And it has it has essentially been that way for 23 years. And yet, I think I've tried to win in a way that enables us to stay within the rules. That wasn't always a prerogative at Indiana, however. But the people have been very receptive to the way that we've tried to go about things. You always, when you're in coaching, and I'm sure that in journalism it's the same thing. You have an opportunity to be in a situation that you like, but but here is a publication somewhere else. Here is a storied newspaper in another city. Here is a city that I'm sure you've all given at one time or another thought to what it would be like to work in New York or Washington or wherever, or to change jobs. And coaching is no different than that. And yet, I sit around and contemplate things in coaching. And to give you a little bit of an idea of what coaching is all about, how would you like to? Now, I look over this group, and I'm almost certain, with an exception right here, and first of all, we have a very intelligent young lady here, so she becomes an exception to my little statement here, but my God, there can't be any former sports writers in here. I mean, you people just look too smart to have ever to have ever gotten a start like that one. But when you're coaching, you think about things, and a guy once told me, he said, well, let's say that when your time here is done and you go on, would you like to coach in heaven? I mean, do you hope that that's what's in store for you down the way? And I thought about it a little bit, and I said, no, I said, not really. I said, you know, heaven would be a really tough job. I said, just think about what their biggest game is every year. You know, I mean, heaven's playing hell. Now think of the reputation that's on the line in this game, and the pressures to win that game, and what would happen if you'd lose. You'd disappear for all time, ever. I mean, your spirit is gone if you lose that one. I said, no, I said, I'll tell you what, though. I said, I've really given some thought to about the time I think I've fulfilled my usefulness at Indiana University. I would not mind coaching in Michigan City at the state penitentiary. And I said, I think that would be a hell of a job coaching at the state penitentiary. I said, you've got three great advantages coaching there. I said, your entire schedule's played at home. You never have to go on the road. I said, can you imagine how officials would feel about making a tough call against you? And I said, and maybe most of all, the alumni are not coming back telling you what the hell to do with your job. Well, you know, I thought that what I might do before we move on to questions and answers, there are some current issues involving intercollegiate athletics, not necessarily basketball, although obviously basketball is a part of it. And I thought I would go through some of the current issues that are before all of us that are in athletics and those that really just have an interest in it, those that think there are some good things, and I happen to think there are a lot of good things about intercollegiate athletics. And those of you that have lived and worked here for a long time will not find this at all surprising, but I was involved in a dinner party at a golf tournament a couple of years ago with six congressmen from both parties, from fairly well around the country. And the NCAA came up, and if you'll recall, Congress has had different proposals before it relative to the legislation of the NCAA as a body, and I was amazed, and I'm sure you would not have been, at how little these people knew about the NCAA, and how surprised they were when upon saying something and at that time there was some there's always been some problem with Nevada Las Vegas before the NCAA, but at this time there was a particular problem, and I explained a couple of the ramifications of it and what could happen to players that were there currently that had nothing to do with this particular problem, and these people just were surprised at the fact that, as an example, a kid caught up in a penalty for which he had no responsibility could transfer somewhere else without losing eligibility. before I would talk about the NCAA and problems confronting the NCAA, I would then just simply say that it's really important, and I kind of had to go through this as a coach, to be able to distinguish between the NCAA, which actually is Kansas City, and is an administrative body, the executive branch of college athletics, if you will, in charge with enforcing the rules, not making the rules. Our Congress in intercollegiate athletics is the membership itself. Indiana is a congressman in the membership. Notre Dame is a congressman in the membership. Have we got any Notre Dame graduates here? Well, you know, I'm pleased that we do have, because Notre Dame's one of my favorite institutions. I mean, I think there is an honesty and integrity about Notre Dame, and you'll recall from your days there that when you go through the main gate, immediately on the right is the statue to the guy that invented bingo. I mean, that's, you know, that's honesty in a university, and I like that. If we can kind of understand then that it's Notre Dame and Indiana and all the rest of the schools that make the rules, it's not Kansas City. I always felt that when Walter Byers was the director of the NCAA, that left to autonomy, he would have really done a fantastic job in running intercollegiate athletics. What interfered with Walter or any head of the NCAA is Congress, the membership. The membership of the NCAA creates the problems. And I was just going to go through some things that have been here a little bit in the forefront relative to athletics here in the past year or so, and then certainly try to answer any questions over these questions or anything else that you may have. My favorite American politician is probably Harry Truman, but next to him is Pogo. I mean, I think that there are some truths that come from Pogo that we really don't get from most other American political figures, with maybe the exception of Truman. And it was Pogo who, I think, very adroitly said that we has identified the enemy and they is us. Well, I think that really pertains to what we have in college athletics today as problems. But I reiterate a statement I made just a moment ago. I do think that there are an awful lot of good things that come through intercollegiate athletics. I think the good far outweighs the bad, but the bad receives a little more publicity than the good does. First thing that I would get into a little bit is academic standards. And I would be the first to say that I think coaches forever, going way back before I played, have always felt deep down that shooting and dribbling or blocking and tackling are sometimes sufficient substitutes for entrance requirements, or are in fact entrance requirements. And I think we as coaches have to understand, or we in athletics have to understand, that what we're dealing with here is higher education. And not everybody is suited for higher education. I mean, how many of us, having had the chance to play baseball at a little league level, would have loved to have gone on to Major League Baseball had it not been for the curveball or a relatively fast thrown ball from an elevated height? To set really low standards for admission to college is simply to say, all right, for these batters, you cannot throw curves. You can only throw straight balls. And I think we've never really fully, as coaches, been able to accept the fact that it is higher education and not everybody is going to be qualified to go on to it. The question today is an increase in entrance requirements beyond what Proposition 48, now Proposition 48 was really the first piece of legislation that covered the country, admission for all athletes. And I remember Arthur Ashe remarking on Proposition 48, saying words to the effect that if you're unable to comply with these standards, you should not be in college in the first place. It was a relatively modest, at best, score on the SAT of 700 and a 2.0 grade average in a set of core courses outlined by the NCAA, as well as a total GPA for the kids' high school record. Now, there was a little drop in minority acceptance of scholarship, but that's right back up, maybe a little higher than it was before Proposition 48. Now, I question the use of raising these standards at this point without going a little bit further to just see how Proposition 48 has affected things. I think that we need a little bit more time to do this. I have a real question mark. Like, I make my players either go to class or they don't play. I mean, it's really simple. People say, well, you have a high graduation rate. How did you get that? Well, it isn't the water in Bloomington. It's just that simple. You know, you either go to class or you don't play. I mean, and then we do it. We got an interesting couple of freshmen right now. They missed a class. They got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and ran. They missed another class, which, you know, I'm not sure that they're smart enough to be there when they missed the second one, because now they got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and ran. Now, the next point is 4 o'clock. You know, I don't ever suspend anybody. I just get them to the point where they can't sleep. They get so tired they have to quit if they miss too much class. And that's the key, I think, to getting people to do what they're there to do, and that's go to class and work toward getting a degree. It seems to me to be kind of a simple proposition. But what I think we have to keep in mind is that our we had a faculty group that wanted to make attending class for athletes mandatory. Well, I completely rebelled at that idea. I said, if you want to make attending class mandatory for all students, then I'm all for it. Now, as I say, I make our players go, but not a university policy that would exclude everybody but the athlete from mandatory class attendance. And I don't think that we should, in intercollegiate athletics, devise entrance standards for kids to participate in athletics that are beyond what the normal entrance standards for that particular school or university might be. I think that we need a closer look at the elevation of academic standards right now beyond those which would be required of the normal student who is a non-athlete. I've said for a long time that one of the things that I think would really help us academically, and this would be something really aimed at the coaches, not at the players, that before you can issue a new scholarship, it has to be given to replace a kid who has graduated with a degree. I mean, that seems to be kind of a logical proposal to me. Now, you work out the logistics of it. Kid transfers. Did he transfer in good standing going on to get a degree? Kid goes on to play professional football or basketball or baseball before he graduates. Allowances can be made for different things. Logistics have to be worked out. But basically, what would be wrong with only replacing kids who have gotten a degree with scholarships? And if a kid plays 4 years and within a valid amount of time, say 4 years and another semester or 5 years, doesn't complete degree work, that scholarship has to sit idle for 2 years. Now that puts a real burden on me as a coach to make sure that my kids are getting done what I think they're there for, and that's to get a degree, to get a college education, to provide themselves with something suitable for the future. You see, I think that there should be options for kids right now. The NFL and the NBA use us, colleges, as minor leagues. Baseball has never done that. A kid has the option or the choice of going into minor league baseball, not really going into minor league football or basketball. And I've always said that they each should sponsor leagues that enable a kid coming right out of high school. Who doesn't want to go to college? He didn't like to go to class in high school. He hasn't done very well in high school. Why the hell should he go to college? Because he can dribble and pass. I think that kid should have an opportunity to go right into professional basketball and work toward becoming a professional basketball player, if that in essence is what he wants to do. And I think the same thing should be available to kids going on into football if they want to become professional football players. It's amazed me, however, that presidents and athletic administrators have just almost to the person stayed away from any thought of involving the degree in the issuing of future scholarships. If we really are concerned about athletes going to class and progressing as normal students, then it simply seems only logical to me that the degree be used as a device to bring that about. I think a lot of really undue criticism is probably aimed at colleges and universities right now relative to the academics of athletes. I think the point of emphasis should be at the junior high school level, not at the entrance to college level. I'm not sure that entrance requirements to college are the point of attack or should be the point of attack. I think it's the recognition of the kid with athletic ability and then his encouragement and an emphasis placed on what he does academically to provide him or her with an opportunity to take advantage of this athletic ability beyond the junior high school or the high school level. And I would like to think that we would be far better off targeting what happens in the 7th, the 8th, or the 9th grade with these kids, rather than trying to devise a situation 3 years or 4 years down the road where colleges and universities are going to accept people because of athletic skills. That's a little synopsis and some thoughts that I have on academic standards. The rules, the NCAA rule book is perhaps the most complicated manual that anybody works with in any organization in the country. We just had, as an example, a boy visit our campus in a non-paid visit, which meant that he had to take care of the visit. Now, to give you an idea what this means, if he went to a place where our players lived off campus, he either had to walk or go by cab. He stayed in a motel off our campus. We could, my coaches, myself, our players, take him to the edge of our campus and drop him off, and then he had to walk to the motel. We took him to eat on our campus, which was fine, but he had to pay for his hamburger and his milkshake. And we had a list with us. It was really kind of interesting. I had this list in my pocket, and every time we turned around, I checked the list to see if we were breaking a rule. What a way for a kid to make a visit. These rules – And rules like them are, I think, rules that need a lot of scrutiny and change or elimination. I think that there's a whole set of rules. If you were to ask me, let's say you're in Indianapolis, and you were to ask me to bring three players to visit the cancer unit at Riley Children's Hospital, and just bring these players in and talk to the kids that are there. I mean, what's worse than a kid that's got a terminal illness? Or you're a principal, and you ask me to bring two of my players to your school to talk about reading and talk about the importance of what they did academically or what they're going to do academically. They can't ride in the car with me. I can't give them transportation, even if it's only across Bloomington to one of our junior high schools. Certainly not to Indianapolis, to Riley Hospital, where these three kids will do an immeasurable amount of good in cheering up sick kids by sitting on the bed or signing an autograph or giving a pennant or a basketball brochure. This is the kind of thing that I think is so self-defeating in the NCAA. This is the kind of thing that, as an example, I think the Black Coaches Association was really concerned about, and I think very justifiably concerned. Particularly, you get a team, take Georgetown as an example, or Maryland, or George Washington, or American University, teams in a large metropolitan area where kids can be real role models. And if the university can just take three kids to this junior high school and they can coordinate efforts so that four or five schools are covering all the junior high schools without any worry about breaking a rule, we establish rules that have to be followed that really hinder the good that a college athletic team, its players, its coaches can do in any given community. I made a suggestion to the NCAA a few years ago. It eliminated intra-squad games, just our first team playing its our second team or a division of our team. It eliminated these games from anywhere except on your own campus. What the justification for this was, I really don't know. But let's say that in Indiana, we go to Fort Wayne, which we did for years to play an inter-squad game. You know, when we went to Fort Wayne, 60% of the income from that game went to the girls and boys clubs of Fort Wayne, went to a school for learning disabilities, went to the YMCA, the YWCA, all to different youth activities. And the remainder of it went into our library fund for the use of all students and all faculty members. Now, what better purpose could there be for Indiana's basketball team than to supply some funds that these organizations could use to cover operating expenses? Yet the NCAA did away with this. And what I prevailed upon them to do was, hey, reinstitute off-campus intra-squad games with a stipulation that a certain percentage of it go to things to benefit kids that have nothing to do with the university's athletic program. But again, as Pogo so aptly said, we has identified the enemy, and they is us. Then the last area that I would get into here because of time, and I'll do so quickly, is the exploitation of kids who are athletes. Well, first of all, understand this point. The maximum salary that can be paid a AAA baseball player is $24,000. The cost of an education, the amount of travel involved, the exposure that a kid gets through television of basketball or football games, the contacts that a kid makes while he's an athlete at any college or university, the opportunities that he has because he is an athlete for summer employment or future employment, I think it would really come very close, maybe surpassing in a lot of cases the maximum salary that a minor league baseball player at the highest level at AAA is allowed to be paid. So in effect, there is something coming back to the individual athlete. Now, I disagree completely with the athletic department that uses the pictures of athletes or the likenesses of athletes or uses its individually standout players, the All-American, the MVP of the conference, in different ways to exploit that in terms of bringing back revenue to the athletic department. In our situation, football and basketball, and usually football and basketball are, we have 21 sports in Indiana, men and women's sports. We have two revenue sports, football and basketball. So they allow an additional 600 kids to take part in intercollegiate athletics. This past year, football and basketball through these other 19 sports made it possible through scholarships that are paid for by the revenue of football and basketball to account for 75 degrees with sports other than football and basketball. So there are some really good things that can happen with intercollegiate athletics. And if we had just a common sense approach to this myriad of rules in the NCAA, there are a lot more really good things that could be accomplished with intercollegiate athletics, and that I'm open to whatever questions you have. But now just make damn sure they're smart, intelligent questions here.
Reggie, you want to do this? Okay.
Clayton, what the hell are you deferring this to Reggie for? I mean, is there some, do I sense a hesitation on your part for getting up here?
No, not at all. First question is, will Calbert Chaney become a superstar in the NBA?
I really think that Chaney will be a very good player. He's our All-American player from last year, who is the outstanding player in the country, who went to the Bullets as their number one draft choice. A little interesting sidelight story on Chaney. There's an award given by the Los Angeles Athletic Club called the Wooden Award for the outstanding player in college basketball that the Los Angeles Athletic Club, I think, in a self-styled way, has proclaimed the Heisman of basketball. Well, I think most coaches would tell you that the award given by the Kodak Company in Rochester is a premier award given to college basketball players. Chaney did not go to California to accept the Wooden Award because he had two tests to take, one on Wednesday, which would have been the day of travel, another on Thursday, which would have been the day the award was given, plus the fact that the LA, the Los Angeles Athletic Club, tries to simulate the Academy Awards by not saying who won the award until it's presented, which seems to me to be a way to try to get five kids there to run around and talk to the people that are there and let everybody enjoy that. Well, Chaney was right on target to graduate. He did graduate. Two other players, Weber from Michigan and Hardaway from Memphis State, were both there. Now, this is where I have a little bit of problem with the press. These two, among others, but these two kids, Hardaway and Weber, were written about as, God, what, you know, these two young men came to Los Angeles. These two young men were here. Well, both of them had quit school. I mean, neither one of them was in school. They were juniors. They both had quit. Weber was a sophomore. They hadn't gone to class for a couple weeks. They went out to Los Angeles to have a hell of a good time for a week. And Chaney stayed home to take two tests. And Chaney and I were both just thoroughly criticized for his not going out there to receive the award. That a little bit of my side of the coin.
Why is it so hard to predict whether a player will do well in the NBA? Why can a player do very well in the Big Ten but fail in the pros?
College basketball and the NBA are a little bit different. I mean, it's like writing sports, I'm sure, and writing politics or whatever. And you can make analogies in your own profession. But being a really good college player, because of size, quickness, position, doesn't always mean that the kid is going to be a great pro player. It's just like when we recruit a kid out of high school, outstanding high school player, but we're really never positive. That I didn't think Chaney could play. First time I saw Chaney play, he hit 6 out of 32 shots and thought rebounding was for the other 9 guys on the floor. I mean, he thought there was a rule against good-looking black kids wearing number 32 rebounding in this ball game or something. I'm not sure what the hell it was. But, and then all of a sudden, things change a little bit, and he was a great college player. So going from one step to another is never really an easy thing to predict.
You have already touched on this in your talk, but a questioner asks, black college basketball coaches recently objected to NCAA regulations that prohibit them from spending more time with student athletes and recruitable athletes. Could you talk specifically about what they're barred from doing and whether you think they'll be successful in getting that repealed?
Well, I think I did cover that, the idea of not being able to involve kids in community projects or take kids to different things because of all the little rules that you've got to follow. And I would hope that the NCAA, both the membership and the administration, I would like to see the administration in Kansas City just simply say, hey, you know, this is ridiculous that we don't allow these athletes and these coaches to do whatever they can in a community to work with drug and alcohol abuse, to enhance reading skills among junior high school students. Let's get rid of all this prohibitive stuff. I would hope the NCAA in the administrative level takes a step in this regard. I would like to, I don't know what the hell I got here. I'm looking, $20 is too much, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to put $10 here as the first contribution toward getting the moderator a microphone for his chair so that he can ask the question over his microphone and your next speaker can just answer the question. I mean, I think don't ever let it be said that I haven't had the interests of the press at heart. There's my $10.
Thank you very much. Could you tell us about
and let me tell you something, Ross. You have identified the $10. Now you better make damn sure the $10 goes to a new microphone, and I can tell you that I'll know whether it did or not.
Could you tell us about the recruits you've signed recently?
The NCAA, again, has a policy that prevents me from talking about recruiting. Interesting. It seems to me that somewhere in the Constitution they told me I could talk, but the NCAA says no.
Some of the comments you've made or made comments that have been made during the debate on entrance standards seem to suggest that coaches and recruiters have a social work role. Do they and should they?
Well, I really believe the role of a coach is multidimensional. The role of a coach is as a teacher, a parent, a counselor, all kinds of things. If I bring your son to Indiana, I'm going to be closer to him during the next 4 years than you are. Perhaps not closer in emotionally, but certainly closer in terms of knowing what he is or is not doing, what he should be doing or what he should not be doing. So I think it's incumbent upon me as the head coach with these 12, 13, or 14 kids that I have in the basketball program, it's incumbent upon me to make sure that I've created an atmosphere in which your son can develop to the fullest extent possible. Now, you may not always agree with how I do that, but as I study your son, I'm not going to agree with how you've brought the kid to being 18 years old either.
Okay, you've talked about high school students going directly into professional basketball. Should the professional basketball teams form minor leagues as they have in baseball?
Well, that's exactly what I was saying and what I think should happen. It doesn't have to be a team for a minor league team for every one of the 27 or 28 franchises. What, maybe two franchises have one team, and players that they have signed to minor league contracts make up that team. They do that in summer basketball with college, with kids that no longer have college eligibility. And I just feel that for those kids that just that college is simply a way to have a chance to play football or basketball, that then let's give them the opportunity to be football or basketball players without the hindrance of history classes.
In your opinion, what's the solution to the increasing level of violence in professional basketball?
Well, you just I think the NBA has done a pretty good job with the violence. I'm reminded of a story by perhaps one of my two or three favorite players about another one of my favorite players. I had the good fortune of playing with John Havlicek in college, and when he was playing with Dave Cowens, they were playing down in Houston one night, and Cowens got called for a rather chintzy foul, and the next time down the floor, Cowens just leveled the guy. Same guy. I mean, just wiped him out. Went to the official and said, "Now, damn it, that's a foul." Now, that doesn't answer the question about violence, but it does indicate that there is an amount of physical contact in basketball. I mean, dancing is a contact sport. Basketball is a physical sport. Guys banging and bumping, and so there's always going to be some problems arise with somebody that doesn't accept banging and bumping like somebody else does. And the answer, I think, always to controlling something is the penalty imposed. If the penalty imposed is strong enough, then not a whole lot of situations are going to get out of hand. That's just like in recruiting violations. Simple way to handle recruiting violations is the school involved doesn't play any home games next year. And all they get would be travel expenses to their 11-game road schedule in football or their road schedule in basketball. Just like if I can only give a scholarship for a kid that has a degree, I mean, I'm going to make damn sure kids are in class and doing what they have to do. And if I'm not going to have any home schedule next year, there's not going to be a lot of violation of rules involved at my school.
Two questions on women's sports. Is there too much emphasis on men's sports versus women's teams, including basketball? And since the job description for basketball coach for both men and women's teams is the same, should the base pay for both should be the same?
I don't think the pressure on men and women coaching is the same. I think the pressure on men, simply because it's a revenue-producing sport. It's a sport, basketball. My wife was a basketball coach. I mean, and she coached for in Oklahoma in high school. Her teams won 3 state championships. They're undefeated the last year she coached. She's in the Oklahoma Coaches Hall of Fame. I come home at night after a tough game. I'm tired. I like to have a cup of tea, and my wife says, "You didn't get the ball into the post very well tonight." She says, "When they changed the zone, all you did was go down the right side. Did you forget there's a left side? About this time, I say, damn, I said, can't you go bake a cake or something? Is there anything that you could? Well, I think that basketball is a bad sport, because in basketball, there's a comparison between girls and boys, or men and women playing the sport, that's really unfair to the female side, because they can't play it like men can play it. They are never going to play it like men can play it. Basketball is a game that just can't be played by both sexes equally well. And therefore, I go back to my original point. I think our whole society is based on things like the person with the most responsibility, the most pressure, the most responsibility to succeed, whoever applies that kind of pressure in whatever walk of life it's going to be is the person that the editor of a paper has a hell of a lot more responsibility than the sports editor has. And the sport may be the same, it may be basketball, but it isn't played the same way, and the expected results in almost all cases aren't the same. And so I think that brings about a difference in pay scales, just like anything in the country has a difference in pay scales.
I'd really like to hear you discuss the matter of your anger. Are you successful because of it or in spite of it?
Anger over what? You know, whoever asked the question, just simply tell me, anger over what? I mean, are you a person that's been in my hip pocket every day of my life? I mean, are you, I remember reading this story about a guy that got a little bit upset and people did better. Patted everybody on the back. I mean, every once in a while, there are demands that have to be made on people when you're in a leadership position. Like, I do a little thing with this class I teach. I still teach a class. It's a little insignificant class, except that if you cut it once, you get a C. If you cut it twice, you fail it. If you attend class every day, I mean, if you're going to teach, you better be there every day. And so I have this, my group of students, about 100, probably a third of them are girls, and I think most of the rest are boys. And with clothes and so forth, I'm not always sure, but the gals are the best. I mean, the gals I have are the best students. They're the most responsive, the most attentive, the best organized. And I have no hesitation in saying that. I tell them that. I said, if one of you guys can finish in the first 15 in this class, I give you an A+, not just an A. But, well, they never do. The girls beat them every time. Well, anyhow, the first day of class, I say, okay, now how many of you had a coach that you didn't like? Well, pretty soon there'll be a courageous girl that raises her hand. Then another, then pretty soon every hand in the room is up. 100 hands. We each, and I'm the only instructor, teacher, coach in the room. And there's a twofold thing here. The kids are showing me, hey, we don't buy everything that you coaches say. Just because you're a coach, that doesn't mean you're right about it, which is good. I like that, and I appreciate that. 100 hands telling me that each had a coach that he or she did not like. And I make them keep their hands in the air, and I look the room over, and I say, now this is going to be your first lesson in teaching. We don't like all you little bastards either. And I want them to understand that because of what they're going to have to do with teaching and with coaching. I think they have to understand where they're coming from. Then I say, all right, now I want you to put down the names of the two best teachers that you've had in your educational experience to this point. Go back as far as you can remember, kindergarten, preschool, first grade, whatever your limitations are, and write down the two best teachers. Then beside that, write down, and I give them a little time, first of all, to write down the two best teachers. Then I say, all right, beside those two, write down the two most demanding teachers. Invariably, they're the same two people. And I find that kids appreciate demand, and kids like demands being placed on them. Is demand synonymous with anger? Who am I angry with in any given situation? What is anger? What is demand? That's kind of a bad question, really.
Is Henderson's knee okay? This person asks.
Henderson's knee is pretty good. We always introduce Henderson as a forward because his mother didn't want him to be a center. And so when we introduce our starting lineup, it's number 44 at forward for Indiana, Allen Henderson. Well, his mom is up cheering and clapping and ready. Go get him, Allen. That a boy, Allen. Well, then I play him at center. She has no idea where the hell he's playing when we get started. I play him where I want to play him. And because he's this is the power of suggestion in the media. You know, whether it be electronic or the PA system or in the newsprint. We introduce him as a forward, so she's content to think he's playing forward while I got him playing center.
I hope Mrs. Henderson doesn't watch C-SPAN. Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for speaking here today and a National Press Club mug, which does not sell for more than $10, so maybe I should give you that $10 bill back. The last question is, would you go fly fishing with Bill Clinton?
Only if I could pick the place where we're going, determine which one of us were going to fish the water first, and insist that we each bring our own first aid package.